Thanks, Vanessa, for inviting me on. So I was sacked in on the 1st of October 2021 for not meeting the standards expected of staff by the university. That's what they said they sacked me for. I took them to an industrial tribunal. The tribunal found that that wasn't the reason that I'd been sacked, that the reason I'd been sacked was because I had anti-Zionist views and that the university thought they were intolerable. The court further determined that those views, as expressed by me, were what's called worthy of respect in a democratic society, and thus worthy of protection as philosophical beliefs under the Equality Act 2010. And so that establishes the principle in an industrial tribunal, an employment tribunal, that anti-Zionist views should be protected. And these are not, let's be clear, mild anti-Zionist views. I expressed my anti-Zionist views extremely robustly in the court documents, and these are now held to be protected. The idea that that Israel is fundamentally racist and indeed genocidal is amongst those ideas which are held to be protected. So now the university is appealing. The appeal will happen in November of this year, quite a long way away still. But the basis on which they're appealing is that the judgment was wrong in the law. And one of the things which the university's lawyer said at the tribunal was that there was another case ongoing at the time, which the lawyer for the university said he was confident would be thrown out, and this would, should first of all, should cause the court to be cautious about finding in my favour, and second of all, should cause them to actually reject my arguments. Now that case is, of course, the case of Higgs, the Christian teacher in I think a Wiltshire school. If I might just explain briefly what happened there. She's a Christian teacher who made critical comments on her personal Facebook on the school's policy on promoting gender ideology, which she opposed. And she was sacked for this, and she took them to tribunal. The tribunal said that she'd been rightly sacked because her views were not worthy of protection in a democratic society. She took that to an appeal, and the appeal asked to refer that back to the original tribunal. She wasn't happy with that. She went to the appeal court. And the appeal court, just the other week, in a swinging judgment, came down in her favour and blew away all of the nonsense which had been erected both by the school and indeed by the original tribunal. Now, the key point which they came down in her favour on was that not just that her underlying Christian beliefs should be protected under the Equality Act, like my underlying anti-Zionist beliefs, but also that the manner of her expression of those beliefs was protected and was had a clear and direct nexus in the legal speak. To her underlying beliefs. Now, that was precisely the area which the University of Bristol tried to challenge me on and say that actually it was fine for me to have anti-Zionist beliefs and they could be protected and should be protected, but the way in which I had expressed them was problematic, and that distinction which they're seeking to make was thrown out by Higgs. So that strengthens the case,
Right.
our case in the appeal, and that would be interesting to see how that goes in November.
Where can people follow that case, David?
Well, it's the Higgs case. So Higgs versus I forget the name of the school. So if you just look up Industrial Tribunal or Court of Appeal and Higgs, I think her name is Christie Higgs, Kristie, and you'll see the judgments there, and you can have a look. I must write something about this. I haven't managed to get around to that yet. The thing which I try and explain to people is, look, of course, there's such a thing as the Israel lobby, and everybody now knows that after the taboo on discussing it was broken by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt back in the mid 2000s when they published their famous book, The Israel Lobby and US Foreign Policy. And in that book, they do many things, what they mostly concentrate on are those groups which are. Which is Zionist, yes, but are focused on altering US foreign policy in the interests of the Zionist movement or the State of Israel. So obviously AIPAC is figures big in the index, and there's the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and WENF and all of the other groups people have come to know as being part of the Israel lobby, including, of course, the Anti-Defamation League in the US. Now, there's a similar book in one respect in the UK, which deals with the US as well, which is Ilan Pappé's recent book, Lobby for Zionism. And he also treats the Israel lobby, or the Zionist lobby, as he calls it, in the same way. He's interested in those lobby groups which are trying, which historically have been and continue to try and influence UK and US and other governments' policies, and including also, of course, potentially domestic policies, which are not so often talked about. But that, these groups which do this in the UK, for example, BICOM, the PR lobby group for the Zionists, or the Community Security Trust, or the United Jewish Israel Appeal, the Jewish Leadership Council, etc. Now, these are all, I think, reasonably said to be Israel lobby groups, pro-Zionist lobby groups. But what I have come to understand is that the Zionist movement is something which is bigger than just the question of the Israel lobby. Now, the Zionist movement, of course, was started in the 1880s or 1890s by Theodor Herzl, and after he wrote the book The Jewish State, Der Judenstaat. And the idea of the Zionist movement was to create a Jewish state in the historic territory of Palestine after they rejected Patagonia and Uganda and Madagascar as options. Of course, that came with it the necessity that they would have to displace the indigenous people of the region, which, of course, is the Palestinians. And everyone knows that's what they would have to do. They knew that they would have to do that, and they said so in their various books and pamphlets. So in order to do that, yes, of course, they had to lobby governments, and of course they got protection and support from the UK and then laterally the US government. But what they also had to do was provide people and resources to instantiate the Zionist colony in Palestine. Now, to do that, that's not a job for the lobby. I mean, the lobby might have a role in it, but it's a job for the movement to inculcate in their followers the idea that they had what they now call a birthright to the historic land of Palestine. The Jews have an intrinsic birthright to Palestine. It's their right to go there and to settle there and to steal the land and to kill the Palestinians. I mean, they don't put it as explicitly as that, but that's, of course, what they mean. Now, in order to do that, you have to do a whole series of other things than just convince the British government that Zionism is a good idea. You have to, I said inculcate, I was using a deliberately neutral word there, but you have to indoctrinate your followers. And the way in which the Zionist movement does that is that it has a huge infrastructure for indoctrination, radicalization, and grooming of Jewish young people into believing racist ideas like that they have a birthright to the historic territory of Palestine. And how do they do that? Well, they do it through schools, primary schools and secondary schools. They do it through youth groups. There are 15 separate Zionist youth groups around the world, depending on where the Zionist movement is involved. For example, in the UK, there are perhaps eight of these youth groups are organised in the UK with branches in Manchester or Leeds or London, sometimes Glasgow. And so that they have youth groups, they have schools, including primary and secondary schools. And I think people may not be appreciate this, but these are Jewish schools which openly claim to be Zionist. So they're not just teaching religious observance; they're teaching Zionism, and they say this on their websites. And that's the case with most Jewish schools in the UK, of which there are something like 130. Or 140. They also, of course, have they put on trips for school kids, school age kids, to go to occupied Palestine to get a taste for what they can come and have should they decide to become settler colonists. And they also, of course, help to recruit young Jews into a path to join the occupation forces. So there's a lone soldier program. There's a whole series of different programs to recruit individual young Jews from the UK, the US, Argentina, France, Germany, Brazil, and other places. And as far as we know, there are something like 3,000 British citizens in the so-called Israel Defense Forces. There are many more, I think like 8 or 9,000 French citizens. There are thousands of American citizens, etc. So the movement has to recruit people to follow their movement and to act to support their movement, whether that's through joining the IDF or becoming settlers or just from outside Palestine, providing resources and ideological cover for the movement. And that's the important distinction between the Israel lobby and the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement does these broader things, and the Israel lobby is a part of the Zionist movement.
You recently came to the heart of resistance access territory. You came to the funeral, which I also attended, of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah and Sayed Shafieddine, both of whom were assassinated by Israel brutally in the last very recent war between the resistance forces in Lebanon, which is not only Hezbollah, and Israel, the Zionist entity. I'd love to, because we haven't actually spoken. I found the entire ceremony quite extraordinary for a number of reasons, but I'd love to hear how you felt about it. You know, what effect did it have on you, both being there and also taking part in what was, for me, just an overwhelming show of solidarity and respect and love for a leader that has been, of course, vilified by the Western alliance of the Zionist movement.
Well, I mean, I had been to Beirut before once, some years ago. I had never been down to the south. So I arrived in Beirut a couple of days or 3 days, 4 days before the funeral. And the first thing which struck me driving in a taxi into the centre of Beirut was the sheer number of the massive billboard ads. With images of Safieddine and of Nasrallah, and indeed of other senior Hezbollah commanders who had been martyred by the occupation. And then every lamppost would have, first of all, a Lebanese flag, and second of all, a Hezbollah flag, all the way in. I mean, like thousands and thousands of flags, huge advertising billboards. And you couldn't mistake the kind of the orientation of the city towards Hezbollah. And the next few days I spent some time going down to the south and down to Marun El Raz, a village right on the border with the occupation, and also to a village called Kafr Kila, which again is right on the border. That was one of the first, two or three of us went there, and we were the first Westerners to get into Kafr Kila after we evaded a Lebanese army checkpoint to do so. And what we saw there was just a scene of utter destruction. I mean, almost every building. I mean, in Marun El Ras, 97 or 98% of the buildings were damaged or destroyed. Just incredible. People were just coming back at that stage. We went to a place in Marina Raz called the Iran Garden, which had been funded by the Islamic Republic of Iran, had a massive statue of the famous leader of the Quds Force of the IRGC, who of course was assassinated by Trump in 2020,
Qasem Soleimani.
Soleimani, and also had. They had some, a play park for kids. There was a replica of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, etc. It's on a hill overlooking Israeli settlements, just literally hundreds of yards away across the wall, which had been erected by the Israelis, and the whole thing had been destroyed. All that was left of this statue of Soleimani was a bullet-riddled head. which was on the ground when we got there. And you, I mean, the destruction was extraordinary. And the same was true also in Kafakila, where you could see from a hill overlooking Kafakila, which is where the UN base is, and the UN base was still functioning. And you could see what had happened was that they had left the UN base untouched, and instead they had targeted all the civilian infrastructure of the village, yeah, including, of course, the water tank up on the hill, which had been destroyed by a missile. Well, they'd set houses on fire. They'd broken. I got photographs of people's own cars, which had been broken into and stolen from by the IDF. You could see how they'd done that. I mean, just extraordinary destruction, and yeah. That was sobering to see the destruction. And also, of course, the olive trees, which have been, you know, the olives from that particular village are, as I came to know, actually well known as in terms of the quality of the oil that they produce. And the olive trees have been systematically targeted, especially the older ones, and had either been destroyed or had been stolen and taken back to occupied Palestine. So you saw the total contempt for the people of Lebanon and the south of Lebanon, which the IDF had nothing to do with, of course, targeting alleged terrorists or alleged Hezbollah fighters. Mm-hmm. So then that's a sort of preface to then talking about the funeral itself. I mean, the funeral itself, mm-hmm, as people would have seen, the coverage, to the extent that they saw the coverage, you know, it was a huge, huge event. The biggest stadium in the city, and outside the stadium with thousands and thousands of seats and screens set up so people could watch the ceremony inside. It was said there was more than 1 million people there. I don't know if there was or not, but there was certainly hundreds of thousands. I mean, it was a huge, huge event. And the sheer noise inside the stadium of chanting and a supplication was just extraordinary. I mean, I was in the press box, the international press box. I like to make a joke that I was there with BBC and Reuters and CNN. Of course, they weren't there. So I was right next to a women's section of the stadium, and there was predominantly young women in hijabs, all chanting and fists in the air.
Yes.
And very, very emotional. And, you know, yeah, I sort of reflect, you know, what is the similar kind of cultural event that you would get in the UK, which is comparable to that kind of outpouring of emotion, of political consciousness, of resistance consciousness. And of course, there isn't anything like that in the UK in terms of the politics of that. I mean, the closest you get to the kind of emotional outpouring, I guess, would be something like the funeral of Princess Diana in the UK. But, you know, of course, the politics of that is altogether more muted and a little different. It might mention you know, landmines or something, but that's about as far as you get. Whereas a full-throated resistance consciousness was very, very evident in the stadium. And when I was stopped on the way back from Beirut by the counterterrorism police of the former special branch, SO15, they're called now, they were sort of asking me about, you know, how many of the people who were there, you know, were supporters of Hezbollah. I mean, there was quite a lot of people there, so I'm not really sure I could confidently say what their state of consciousness was, but certainly there were very many Hezbollah flags, as well as flags of many other political factions and nations, including, of course, as I said to them, there was an Irish flag up the front. I know who had that, but anyhow. So, I mean, so that, you know, it was a truly extraordinary situation and experience. And, you know, you see when you go to something like that, there is nothing like that in British politics, and that's really
nothing.
There is no
leadership like that. That's why I mean, you know, Said Nasrallah has inspired people for how many years now? I mean, decades, right? And even, I mean, I remember when the news came through that he had been assassinated, because there was quite a long delay until they could find his body after the area had been obliterated by bunker buster bombs. And I remember being in Syria and the you know, the shock waves there. I mean, people literally collapsed in the street when it was confirmed, because he hadn't only been a symbol for the resistance in Lebanon, he'd been a symbol for the resistance throughout the entire Axis. And in Syria, of course, Hezbollah had been fighting alongside the Syrian Arab Army for years, since 2011, to eliminate up to that point the Zionist and US, UK-backed terrorists, of course, Turkey, Gulf states, et cetera, et cetera. And the shock was palpable then. And also what I found quite extraordinary was people who had literally been in denial about his death. For them, the funeral, I did see some people. I was outside the stadium. I was very much in the women's section. And I did actually personally witness this, people breaking down because they finally had to let go of this idea that he would reappear. There was no running for cover. There was no panic. There was actually a second of realization what was happening. And then this absolute outpouring of resistance against them, you know, despite the suffering that they'd all gone through for the last 2-3 months. And go on, David.
I think that's right. I mean, obviously we saw the jets. I mean, I was in the stadium, so I didn't see how many jets there were the first time, because they were one of them was over the top. But then they came back in, there was just outrage. I mean, it's the kind of I think I might have posted about it on X at the time. You know, it's the kind of thing which is not going to win hearts and minds in Lebanon. And it's definitely going to make people more determined to confront the occupation. And you know, you can see that in the instinctive reaction of the crowd. The first thing I wrote a piece about this the other day. When you get stopped under Schedule 7, the Terrorism Act, you at an airport or an international train station or whatever, they give you a document which you have to sign, which is the basis on which you're being stopped. The basis on which you're being stopped is that you are being stopped to determine whether you've been engaged in supporting or having involvement in the commission of an act of terror. So you're being investigated to find out if you're actually involved in political violence, essentially. But when they questioned me, they weren't asking about where my bombs were or what I'd done with the gun or whether I was about to set up a branch of the Radwan force in Bristol or the Castle Brigades in North London. They weren't asking me about that. They didn't ask me about that. They instead asked me about people's views, about whether people might be extremists or might be opposing the Western way of life or might support terrorism. Now, of course, those are the actual offences which they're interested in. They're not actually interested in prosecuting you for acts of terror, because they know that almost everybody that they stop is not involved in such things. But instead, there are six specific prescription offences, which is what you get once you prescribe an organisation. Of course, the Home Office maintains a list on its website of which organisations prescribe. And the prescription offences are all to do with having views and expressing views. So, for example, it's an offence to hold a meeting which might have the object of supporting a prescribed organisation. It's an offence to say words which might support or invite support for such an organisation. It's an offence to show symbols or to wear clothing which might suggest that you support such an organisation. I don't know, a Hezbollah flag or a Castle Brigades headband or whatever it might be. And all of these are offences which have nothing at all to do with acts of violence. They're all to do with expressing views about particular political organizations or terrorist organizations, as they would put it. And so the entire effectively apparatus of the state is focused on trying to harass and detain people who might have a criticism or a critique of UK foreign policy, nothing to do with actually trying to stop terrorism, which, of course, as you say, there isn't, as far as I'm aware, a branch of the Qassam Brigades or the Al-Quds Brigades or the Al-Aqsa Martyrs, even, although they're not illegal in North or South London or anywhere at all in the UK. And so that it's obviously a question of political censorship and an attempt to suppress what we might call resistance consciousness, if you like. But the other problem with it, of course, is that it means that the British government can't play any role in trying to negotiate any kind of peaceful settlement in West Asia, because its civil servants are forbidden from speaking directly to the,
Allegedly.
yeah, well, I mean, I mean, yeah, they
Right,
have to be.
because if we get onto the BBC and Al Qaeda in Syria, they quite frequently
Well,
converse
of
with them
course.
and platform them.
That's right, but they're not technically allowed to do it. They have to do it indirectly, and
No.
it has to be deniable and all of that stuff. Yeah, of course, but they can't formally, as British government, do that, and unless they, and of course, there was an exception made in the case of Jalali, but then it was a government, and they would look at whether they should remove the organisation from the
Well, he
terrorism
changed
list.
his name as well, David, so I mean that
True,
makes
to
it
be
all
fair, to be
okay.
fair, he did. That's right. But yeah, so that you know that is a problem, and that's why they should be all these organizations. I mean, especially the four Lebanese and Palestinian organizations should be removed. And they are, of course, Hezbollah in its entirety, Hamas in its entirety, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, which of course is different from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is not proscribed. And then, of course, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which I believe also is in its entirety. So that means that they treat as terrorists, i.e., people engaged in political violence of which they don't approve, everybody who's involved in social movements and in regulation and governance of Hezbollah and Hamas. So civil servants, bin collectors, doctors. All of the people who like in the UK, everyone who works in the Department of Health, the National Health Service, Nationalised Industries, all of those people would be regarded as being terrorists were we to proscribe the UK government in its entirety. So it's a complete nonsense. I mean, the people who are emptying the bins in Gaza are clearly not members of the Qassam Brigades. They're bin collectors and bin emptiers. So it's just plainly absurd to do that, but they have to do that because they've got no other way of actually dealing effectively with what's happening in West Asia, because they of course support the Zionists, and that's been the case for very many years, even although it was the case, let's recall, that the Zionists were engaged in armed struggle against the British in the 1940s, including of course famously the King David Hotel bombing, masterminded by Menachem Begin. And of course, in the 1940s, the Ergun had terror cells operating in the UK. I mean, I've been looking at this recently. For example, there was a cell in Glasgow in the 1940s, which used to meet in the Glasgow Jewish Institute, which was based in the Gorbals. And there were Ergun spies in Britain involved in all sorts of stuff, and there's MI5 files and all this stuff which have now been declassified. So it's not as if the Zionists have not been engaged in directly in armed conflict, terrorism, if you will, against the British state, because they have.
Yeah, and actually, I think we talked about this, but my father, when he was Middle East advisor to Ernest Bevin, who of course was ardently anti-Zionist, as was my father, came under, and many of his peers at that time, like Tony Nutting and Christopher Mayhew and so on, all of whom were pushing back against the Truman settlement plan in Palestine. All of them came under at least threat, some under attack from Hogan and Stern, as you said, the cells that were then embedded in the UK. So I guess that was a very early precursor and a rather, let's say, terrorist one compared to the more subtle infiltration and influence that they now carry out.
Look, the Zionist movement is a transnational phenomenon. Yes, it's got its headquarters in occupied Palestine. And when I say its headquarters, I don't just mean that the occupation is its headquarters. I mean very precisely that the Zionist movement is run by an organization called the World Zionist Organization. And the clue is in the word world there. and it has a headquarters. It has its headquarters in Jerusalem in King George Street, in a building called National Institutions House. Now, also in that building are the other institutions of the World Zionist Organization. And there are three others, which are the four main elements of the Zionist movement. So the World Zionist Organization is the head body, and it has other bodies too. There is, of course, the Jewish National Fund, which is there to steal and expropriate land from the Palestinians and make sure that only Jews can use it. There is the Keren Hazard, the foundation fund, which is there to raise money to bring settlers to settle on the land. Then, of course, there is the Jewish Agency, which is to recruit the settlers to be paid for. So that's the four parts of the Zionist movement, and they're all based in the same building, the National Institutions House, because these are the national institutions of the Zionist entity. Now, each of those has affiliates or members or offices in all of the countries in which the World Zionist Organization is organized, and that's 40 or 50 countries, depending on the organization. So there's a Jewish National Fund in the UK. There's a branch of the Foundation Fund, which is called the United Jewish Israel Appeal. There is, of course, an office for the Jewish Agency in London. And there's a British Zionist Federation, which brings together all the formerly Zionist organizations, which are members of the Zionist Federation, which then, of course, allows them to access the democratic processes of the World Zionist Organization through the World Zionist Congress, etc. So this is an actual functioning organizational set of groups, many thousands of which around the world. And so when people say, yes, of course, Israel might collapse and etc., well, we would still be left with the rest of the Zionist movement. And that is a problem. And the reason it's a problem is, one, that the Zionist movement is fundamental to supporting the continued existence of the State of Israel, and it does that by providing resources, as I've mentioned, in through those four kinds of organizations, but also more directly, resources directly to the so-called defense forces, the occupation forces, and resources directly to settlers and settlements in the West Bank and elsewhere. Without those resources, then the entity would be much more likely to collapse. So that's why I say it's important that not only that we say that we should stop arms going to Israel, and we should support Palestine action when it smashes up Israeli arms firms and suppliers for Israel, but we should also be targeting the Zionist movement itself, because there are, in this country, I would reckon roughly, there are probably 3,000 Zionist organizations. I mean, that's my estimate, which are all engaged in one way or another in supporting the genocide. Now, those organizations, the genocide cannot continue if those organizations are all stopped from supporting the genocide in terms of resources, in terms of the personnel they send, recruiting young kids to go and join the occupation forces or to become settlers. You know, whenever you look at these organizations and the history of Zionist organizations in this country, you see that many of the people who were involved in them in, I don't know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, have ended up being settlers settler colonists in Palestine. Some of the family members stayed behind and they helped to support them, the new settlers, and of course the Zionist movement more generally. So it's important, therefore, that we target the Zionist movement itself for being dismantled in the UK, the US, and wherever else it's organized. And I think that's the kind of element of the Palestine solidarity work which we're not doing enough of. I mean, yes, we do BDS. Yes, people understand that maybe you should boycott Coke or McDonald's or whatever. But actually, we should also be directly boycotting and targeting those organizations which are directly involved in supporting the genocide. So the Jewish National Fund, for example, or the United Jewish Israel Appeal, or the charities which are funded by rich Zionists to fund the IDF. So, for example, the UK Friends of the Association for the Wellbeing of Israel Soldiers, which is a bit of a mouthful, of a charity, which is a British charity, which is supported by a whole range of Zionist family foundations, including, of course, the Lewis family, who own the River Island chain of clothing stores. And they have for many, many years now supported the occupation and the genocide. And hardly anybody is thinking about boycotting them. And they are directly supporting the IDF and settlements, for example. When I'm talking about the Zionist movement, and when I talk about what I call Zionist family foundations, which are the foundations which are set up by rich Zionists to send money to the Zionist movement, to whether that's in the UK, to Zionist groups in the UK or Zionist groups in occupied Palestine. And that is what the Zionist movement is engaged in on a daily basis, including, of course, supporting the schools and the youth groups which radicalize and groom young people. But what you're touching on is something I think which is different, which is different, but which is additional to that kind of Zionist movement activity. And that is in particular the penetration by the Israeli state and in particular its intelligence apparatus of the high-tech industry, of including areas of health and education, surveillance, and all sorts of other cloud computing, etc., all sorts of other things. Now, there's clearly been a strategy of the Israeli intelligence agencies, including especially Unit 8200, which is, this, as you know, it's a signals intelligence unit of the Israeli Defense Forces. And that means that they have been trying to penetrate and gain contracts with all sorts of different countries. And you mentioned the 2030 roadmap, truly chilling. A document which encourages Israeli firms to penetrate the health service. And this, as one example, I mean, I think probably the best example, there's a firm called Oracle, which is led by convinced Zionists, which has the multi-billion contract per year, multi-billion per year contract to provide cloud computing services for the National Health Service, the Ministry of Defence, the Foreign Office, and the Home Office, the last are three of the four, are of national security importance for Britain. And of course, that's where the intelligence agencies of Britain are based. And nobody seems to think it's a problem that a company which has direct connections with Israeli intelligence has access to all this cloud computing infrastructure, and it's truly extraordinary. That's one example. There are many, many other examples. So that's another whole section of concern of Zionist penetration of the UK, for example. There's another area which you use the word infiltration. Look, I think that this is an even more thoroughgoing question, which is the question of infiltration. When the Zionists had their first World Zionist Congress post the creation of the colony in 1948. It was in Jerusalem. I think it was 1951, might be 52. Anyhow, they created a new program for the Zionist movement, because the program for the Zionist movement had previously been creating the State of Israel. But now they'd created the State of Israel, they said, okay, so shall we abolish the Zionist movement, or shall we continue it? And the voted overwhelmingly, I think, with very, very few votes against. They voted to continue the Zionist movement. And the Zionist movement then came up with a new program called the Jerusalem Program, because that's where they were meeting in Jerusalem. And amongst the 5 or 6 key points of the Jerusalem Program, which you can see in our website, Powerbase, or any other place you look it up, one of the key points of the aims of the Zionist movement is to popularize Zionism in the community, by which they mean the Jewish community in particular. But you can see that obviously popularizing Zionism and the Zionist movement in Jewish communities all around the world is going to have the effect potentially of popularizing it in the societies in which they are embedded. And so that's a recipe I suggest for infiltration. Now, of course, if it was the case that the Jews were, as they like to imagine, are discriminated against and the victims of the oldest hatred, then that would be another matter. But actually, Jews are in Western societies, including in the UK, in relatively economically advantaged positions. All the economic data shows that they're more economically advantaged than than any ethnic minority, and indeed more economically advantaged than white people in the UK, for example. So that of course means that if they are overwhelmingly Zionist, which they are, then the possibilities of the Zionists having an influence are massively enhanced by that kind of effectively infiltration. And I think that's a real issue. So when you see the overrepresentation, for example, of Jews in the civil service or in news and current affairs at the BBC, which all of which is supported by data provided by those organizations, and that's a problem. That helps to explain why it is that the BBC is so pro-Zionist. Yes, of course, it's to do with propaganda. Yes, of course, it's to do with the routine structures of BBC reporting, but also it's to do with the fact that there are many Zionists in there, as was revealed actually, interestingly, by Owen Jones in recent months when he revealed the role of Raphael Berg inside the BBC as a kind of go-to for clearing all BBC news coverage of Palestine. So, I think that's another issue. The kind of infiltration that we see, which is quite separate to the formal activities of the Zionist movement, in that it's an informal kind of infiltration.
Yeah, exactly. So, do you have any advice for people? Because, I think when people hear all of this, it sounds overwhelming. Do you know what I mean? And this is something that we always get asked, yes, but what can I do? Right. And I
Sure. Well, I
think,
mean, I think,
it is important to give people an idea of what they can do to counter it.
sure. I mean, so, I mean, what I say is, and people often look at me and think I'm exaggerating, but there are Zionists in every town. There are Zionist organizations in every town, and those organizations can be challenged. They can have complaints made. They can have pickets outside. Each of the 3,000 Zionist organizations in the country have lawyers. They have accountants. So many of them have financial advisors. Each of those have addresses and can be complained about, can be protested against. And you should find out where the Zionist organizations are in your neighborhood. I mean, I live in Bristol. There are many Zionist organizations here. I've been looking recently at Scotland. My count at present is that there's at least 150 Zionist organizations in Scotland. Now, who would have known that without doing that research? So these organizations can all be directly targeted, and people can write to the relevant charity or regulators or the regulators of their financial advisors, etc., etc., and raise awareness of which businesses in the area are run by Zionists and who use the money that they make from those businesses to support the genocide. I mean, I found an example in Glasgow just the other day, which I'm not going to mention the name of because I don't want to alert them. But look, there are business organizations engaged in activities which are regarded in Glasgow as being questionable, but nobody knows. The people involved are Zionists and are involved directly in sending money and supporting settlers and the genocide in Gaza, and that's the thing which we need to have much more knowledge about. And people can find the knowledge by investigating their local area.